All right, now we go on to the difficult unit. Well, that's just, it doesn't have to be, but I'm just telling you that's usually the case, that three for most people is the lowest of their five test scores. I don't want that to be true. I'm just telling you that's the way it is. There's probably several reasons for that I'm not even going to bother to get into, but the unit as a whole is all about energy. And so we have an introductory chapter today called Introduction to Metabolism. Then a chapter on glycolysis and cellular respiration. And then we'll round it off with a chapter on photosynthesis. So it's one way or another, it's all about energy. Now, a couple points to make about this first slide. What you're looking at here is just a generalized representation of what is called a biochemical pathway. A pathway is not a single reaction. Notice that there are, in this case, three reactions, but it can be any number of reactions greater than one for it to be a pathway. It's more specific, though, than just being multiple reactions. A pathway is an arrangement of reactions in which the product of the first reaction serves as the reactant in the second reaction, which then gets turned into a product, which then serves as a reaction in the next reaction, and so on, for however many reactions are involved. So in other words, a biochemical pathway is an end-to-end arrangement of individual reactions, each feeding the next. So A gets turned into B, B into C, C into D. There is therefore, in whatever, however long the biochemical pathway is, there is some original reactant or reactants, and then eventually some final product or products. Everything in between is called an intermediate. If you think of it in terms of goals, the final product is the goal of the pathway. And that's just a definition of pathway, but importantly, just about all of the reactions, or let me start that over, almost none, effectively, I won't say none, but close to none of the reactions that, of the thousands of chemical reactions that make up metabolism, happen in isolation, just as an individual reaction. Almost all of our reactions are really just part of a bigger pathway. So that's important, and we're going to specifically study pathways in glycolysis, cellular respiration, and photosynthesis, but those are just examples. There's all kinds of biochemical pathways. Another important point here that's made in this slide is that however many reactions there are in a pathway, notice that each individual constituent reaction is catalyzed by its own enzyme. So first of all, when you put an enzyme on a reaction, you don't put it to the left of the arrow or to the right of the arrow. That's the positions for reactants and products. You don't want to put an enzyme there because an enzyme is not a reactant or a product. Reactants, remember, get changed into product in a chemical reaction. Well, an enzyme doesn't get changed. It doesn't get used up. It's also not actually necessary for the reaction to occur. It just speeds it up. That's the job of a catalyst. And so it's not really a bystander. It's not just watching, but it's not actually a reactant or a product. It helps reactant get turned into product. So whether a reaction is a rare isolated reaction or if it's part of a biochemical pathway, just about every reaction that's happening in our cells or any cells actually are catalyzed by their own enzymes. So there's three different reactions making up this pathway. Notice it's a different enzyme in each case. Each individual reaction requires its own specific enzyme for just that particular reaction. In other words, there is no master enzyme that can speed up any reaction. You would not want that to be the case. Because if you had one master enzyme, that would effectively turn on all of your possible reactions. And you never want everything to be happening at the same time. There's a lot of things that undo other things. You don't want them both to be happening, right? So biochemical pathways need to be turned on or off depending on what the needs of the cell are at that moment. Biochemical pathways need to be controlled. Well, enzymes are important for speeding up reactions so that they will happen soon enough for us to remain alive. But just as importantly, enzymes provide a way for us to control reactions and pathways. Because without the help of enzymes, most reactions will slow down so much that they're effectively not happening. Right? So we can control pathways by controlling enzymes. Okay, let's go on to 2 and talk about energy in general. Energy is described different ways by different textbooks, but a lot of textbooks use a definition something like the capacity to do some sort of work. And that's true. Energy can be put to use to do something useful, whether it's moving something, which is what work really is physically. It makes something happen that wouldn't happen without the energy present, which is not really a too concrete a definition, but there's many different forms of energy. There's radiant energy, which is light. There's chemical energy. There's mechanical energy, and so on. But whatever the form of energy, there are 2 major categories depending on how that energy is being used at the moment. And those 2 major categories are kinetic energy and potential energy. Now, potential means that something could happen, right? It has the potential to happen. So potential energy is energy, often described as stored energy, that could be put to use, but at the moment is not. Kinetic energy, on the other hand, is often described as the energy of motion, or energy in motion. Even though the spelling is a little bit different, the K-I-N is the same root as in cinema, with a C, meaning moving pictures. Kinetic and kinetic art, for instance, is an art piece that moves, like a mobile, for instance. So this picture illustrates how energy can be transformed between, or converted between potential and kinetic, back and forth in either direction all the time. So we have people at this diving platform, which is higher than the surface of the water, of course. So there's a gravitational gradient here. If you climb the stairs, you're actually going against the gravitational gradient, right? Gravity wants you to fall, not go up. And just like forcing something against its concentration gradient, it wants to diffuse in, you have to supply energy for that to happen, right? So it's, you have to use energy to actually go up the stairs. And when you do that, you're actually investing your body with more potential energy gravitationally. So the kinetic energy of you moving up the stairs is being converted into potential energy. You're more likely to fall, right? You don't fall off of the surface when you're already at the bottom, right? So kinetic energy has been converted into potential. But when you jump off the platform, the reverse happens. You're then converting your potential energy that you've invested into your body into the greater and greater movement as you fall farther and farther down into kinetic energy, in other words. Okay, but potential energy is important for reasons that we'll get into in a couple slides. Slide 3 has to do with laws of thermodynamics. And I don't remember how deeply I got into this when I think it was the first slideshow, maybe not even at all, I just don't remember. But thermodynamics is an important branch of science, not just for biology, but also for physics and chemistry. Thermodynamics has to do with energy transactions. There are multiple laws, but we're only going to pay attention to two in this course, because those are the ones that are mostly directly applicable to the topics in this course. Not that the others aren't important. But we're going to talk about the first law and the second law. Or at least that's their names. It's kind of silly historically. There were the first and second laws. Those were the first two that were put down on paper. And then later on they realized, actually there's something more basic that we should have started with. But by then, the first law was known as the first law for a long time already. And so they made the zeroth law, stuck it before the first law. Well, we're not going to talk about the zeroth or the fourth law, but the first and second. I mean, the zeroth or the third, but we will talk about the first and second. And the first law of thermodynamics you've probably already heard of by an alternative name, which is the law of conservation of energy. To conserve here means that there is no change in the amount. Another way of saying that is that the amount of energy in the universe is constant. It doesn't increase or decrease. And still, in other words, energy can't be created or destroyed. So, even though that's true, energy can't be created or destroyed, it can be transferred and transformed. And this happens all the time. Transfer of energy refers to moving energy from one object to another, whether that object is an organism or not. So in this picture of the predator eating the prey, there's energy in the molecules that make up the body of the now dead prey species, that's being transferred into the body of the predator. Or, you know, if you imagine the breaking a rack of billiard balls, you're transferring energy from the stick to the cue ball, and then from the cue ball to the other balls. That's a transfer of energy. Transformation of energy refers to changing it from one form to another. For example, sunlight striking you in July comes in as radiant energy, but it's going to heat you up. That'll be thermal energy that it's transformed into, for instance. Here you have chemical energy in the form of the bonds making up the molecules of the body of the predator, which is the food, and that's going to be transformed into heat and other forms of energy as well, eventually. Yeah?
You said transfer of energy is just moving the energy from one object to another?
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so that's the first law. The second law has to do with the notion of entropy. And a rough one-word definition of entropy is disorder. One of the things that the second law of energy says is that the amount of entropy, or disorder, in the universe is always increasing. The universe is becoming more and more disordered. Now, if you think back to day one, slide one, I think it was, in the first chapter we looked at, we had about seven things that define living things, right? One of which was a high degree of order. Organisms in general are highly ordered structures. So the second law doesn't prohibit order. It's not to say that you can't make something much more orderly than it was before. In fact, that's what happens whenever an organism is created or other things that aren't living things that are highly ordered. So you can have subsets of the universe that are very highly ordered, but in order to create that increase in order, which would be a decrease in entropy, the only way you can do that is by making everything else in the universe even more disordered than the amount of order you create. So when you add everything together, it ends up being more and more entropy as things proceed. The universe is winding down, more or less, is what the second law says as far as entropy is concerned. Another important point about the second law, though, is that in any given energy transaction, some energy is wasted as heat. Now, it's not to, when I say wasted as heat, that's not to say that heat is not valuable for anything. But heat is energy that is not being put to work moving something. So if the intent is to do work, thermodynamic work as it's defined, heat doesn't help you. It's waste energy in that sense. Another way of saying this really is that there's no such thing as a truly 100% efficient process. You have a certain amount of energy to work with potentially at the beginning. It can never be the case that all of that energy can be put into doing the work for you. An internal combustion engine in a car is a great example of this. It's not even close to 100%. There's a certain amount of energy in the bonds, the chemical bonds of the hydrocarbons that make up the gasoline. A lot of energy in that. When you burn that, as the engine does, most of the energy actually gets wasted as heat, which is why an engine has to have a dedicated cooling system just to keep it from seizing up instantaneously. Only a fraction of that energy actually goes into propelling you down the road. It's also wasted other ways, like you can hear the car, for instance, which some energy goes into that, and so on. But there's no way around the second law. So the energy that you take in as food, for instance, some of that is always going to be wasted in terms of doing work, cellular work, as heat. That's valuable for us, though, right? Because that heat keeps us at a body temperature above the surroundings. Well, usually. Sometimes the surroundings are hotter than body temperature around here. So I don't want you to get the idea that heat is not worth anything. It's just not doing work. Okay. Let's go to four. And talk. Well, there's several definitions I want to get past you in this slide. One of which is free energy. The notion of free energy, which is potential energy. Free energy gets the symbol G, which doesn't seem to make sense, but it's named after Gibbs. So it's often called Gibbs free energy, but sometimes we just say free energy. Anyway, G is the instantaneous value of free energy in a thermodynamic system. So that real definition doesn't really make much sense unless I define what a thermodynamic system is. Well, a thermodynamic system can be just about anything you want it to be as long as you define it. You have one overall set, which is the universe, the entire universe. And when you define a thermodynamic system, which could be an organism, a cell, a chemical reaction, a cardboard box, anything you want, as long as you define it, what you're doing is really splitting the universe into two subsets that don't overlap. One subset is the system as you define it. The other subset is everything else in the universe, which we collectively call the surroundings. Okay, so you separate the universe into system and surroundings. Well, here are three examples of thermodynamic systems. This situation with the diving platform is one. Another is some particles in some little space somewhere. And another one is a molecule that's being broken into smaller pieces. Now, this doesn't have to be the case, but for all three of these examples, it is the case. Well, notice that there's a before and after. So the top is before, or the initial. The bottom is the final state, downward arrow. But what I was trying to say before is that for each of these examples, the initial state for the system features a higher free energy, a higher value of G, and a lower value at the end. But notice that G itself is the value at a specific point in time. So there's a G initial and a G final in each of these systems. But for all of these systems, the value is greater before than after. So it's important to realize that G does not equal delta G. Those are totally different, right? Just like mass of potatoes is not the same thing as change in mass of potatoes, right? For your lab experiment. The delta notation means change. Remember, there's two ways that you could do a subtraction, right? What is the proper way? In other words, delta G equals what specifically? What minus what? Exactly. Delta G equals G final minus G initial. Just like in the potato, the change in mass example in lab, there's really three possibilities here as categories. It could be a positive number, it could be zero, or it could be a negative number, depending on what final and initial values are of G. But what is the only way that this is going to be a negative value? Well, what do you mean specifically? No, it depends on what the values are. I'm saying delta G is always this. It's never the other way around. But what is the only way that delta G is going to be a negative number?
If the final amount is lower, or if the initial amount is higher than the final.
Right. If initial is greater than final, since you're subtracting initial from final, that means delta is going to be negative, right? Only in that case. Well, it happens to be the case for all of these three system examples, because the G value is lower at the final, higher at the initial value. Okay? Well, a negative value of delta G is an important thing to know. Remember, the first law tells us that energy can't be created or destroyed. G is energy. So if you're reducing the value of G, you're not destroying that energy. That energy still exists, but it is no longer free energy. It gets transformed into something else. But it's released from the system, is what it says. All right? Each of these three examples releases energy, because it ends up going to a lower G value. And that's what a system, in a sense, wants to do. A system wants to attain a lower G value, because a lower G value is greater stability. A higher G value is less stability or greater instability. Right, you don't have to worry as much about falling off the ground as you do falling off a tower. Similarly, when you have a high concentration of these particles all in one region, they want to go to the more stable, spread out situation by diffusing. And when you have a complex molecule that really can move around only as a whole, it becomes more free, more randomized, and more stable, therefore, when you break it apart, because each of those can then independently move. It's less ordered. Okay, so there's also an entropy concern here. But systems don't have to feature a negative delta G. These all happen to, though. All right? And so, in every one of these cases, if the system goes according to the arrow from this state to this state rather than upwards, then it's attaining greater stability, it's releasing energy, and its final G value will be lower. Okay, let's talk more about energy in slide 5. Here we have two graphs, and both graphs are graphing exactly the same things on their axes. The y-axis is free energy, which is G. The horizontal axis is time, basically, before and after progress of the reaction. It's labeled, but it's really before the reaction happens and after the reaction happens. So there's a chemical reaction occurring in each of these. But notice what's happening is different based on what the starting and ending values of G are. So in the red one, you start with reactants that have a higher G value than the products will have. Well, that means it's a downhill reaction, energetically speaking. You're going to a lower G value, right? Becoming more stable, as I said before. And the delta G value is simply final minus initial, which in this case is going to be a negative number because final is smaller than initial. That's just the opposite of what's happening in the blue reaction. The reactants have a lower G than the products do. That's an uphill reaction, energetically speaking. So we give separate names to that. That's a positive delta G value, by the way. We give different names to these, which are opposites of each other. Exergonic and endergonic. The ergon part of that word means energy. Exo means out, endo means in. So exergonic literally means energy out. An exergonic reaction features a negative delta G value. Energy is released. And therefore the high value of G that you started with, some of that G value, some of that energy, is what causes this thing to happen. The energy is built in. Which is why one of those examples was a gradient, right? A concentration gradient. I said in lab that a concentration gradient is the source of energy that drives diffusion. By diffusing, it's going to a lower G value, a more stable state. And that's why it happens. Moving something against its concentration gradient, or creating the gradient to begin with, is never going to happen on its own, right? You have to supply the energy to do that. Because it's an endergonic process. Energy in. Notice the energy bubble on each of these slides. In an endergonic process, energy has to be supplied or it's never going to happen. In an exergonic process, energy is released because you're actually using some of that energy for it to happen. Okay, so I'm not going to switch yet. Let me give you a couple more definitions, because I'm working toward giving you three pairs of antonyms. Antonyms are pairs of words that are opposite in meaning from each other, right? I've already given you two of the pairs. I haven't. But let me give you another pair. First, remember what I said metabolism is. What's the definition of metabolism? It's been a while, maybe weeks, since I gave you this definition. But metabolism is the total, the sum of all the chemical reactions occurring within an organism. And that's why metabolism, really, when you get down to it, is life. Life is the chemical reactions occurring in an organism. So that's the overall set of reactions. But you can break that down into two non-overlapping subsets. Two parts to metabolism, in other words, which are anabolism, which is the noun, anabolic would be the adjective, and catabolism, or catabolic reactions. The an and cat are opposite prefixes. You see these in other words as well, like anode and cathode, for instance, in electricity. Another example is there are some fish that are described as anadromous and some that are catadromous. Catadromous fish swim downstream to spawn. Anadromous fish swim upstream. Cat means down, and means up. A catheter is another example. A catheter lets down a fluid. In terms of metabolism, the anabolism part of metabolism is building bigger things up out of smaller things. Catabolism is just the opposite. It's breaking bigger things into smaller chunks. Just like that third example in the slide that showed you three systems. A more complex molecule was being broken into several smaller molecules. That's catabolic. Okay. Now, which of these two reactions shown in 5, the exergonic one or the endergonic one, would you expect to have the ability to operate, to happen on its own? Yes, the exergonic one, because the energy required is in the system. That's why diffusion happens on its own, right? The energy is the gradient. An endergonic process is never going to happen on its own unless you supply energy. I mean, that's not happening on its own. It's never going to happen unless you supply energy from outside. So this brings up the idea of spontaneity. A reaction that will happen on its own, or that can happen on its own, is a spontaneous reaction. Whereas one that can't happen unless you supply energy is non-spontaneous. So now we have three sets of antonym pairs. Three of them go hand in hand, but really describe different aspects of the same thing, and the three opposites go hand in hand and describe different things. So let me just say explicitly that an exergonic reaction goes hand in hand with a catabolic reaction. And goes hand in hand with a spontaneous reaction. Okay, if you're dismantling a big complex molecule into smaller molecules, that is catabolic by definition, right? You would use the word catabolic if what you're wanting to describe is what's happening to the size of the molecules. But doing so reduces the G, just like in the slide before. So that means it's also exergonic. You would use the word exergonic if what you're trying to describe in that situation is what's happening to the energy. And it's also spontaneous. It will happen on its own. So you would use the word spontaneous if what you want to describe is whether or not it will happen on its own. They all describe the same situation, but different aspects of the situation. If you think about that same thing, which in slide 4 was the final column, the big molecule going to smaller. If you run that in reverse, you can build a big molecule out of smaller things, right? That happens all the time in cells. But that is anabolic in that case, endergonic, because it requires energy to do that, and non-spontaneous, because it's never going to happen unless you supply energy for it to happen. Okay? Same can be said for running either the other two in reverse, or any system that has a negative delta G. To run it in reverse would mean a positive delta G, and therefore that would mean non-spontaneous. Negative delta G corresponds to spontaneous and exergonic. Positive delta G corresponds to non-spontaneous and endergonic. Now we can go to 6. And look at a couple examples of a thermodynamic system. Now, I just told you earlier that a thermodynamic system can be just about anything you want it to be as long as you define it. That's true. But whatever the specific system is, it's in one of three categories thermodynamically. So there's three categories of thermodynamic systems. One of which is an open system. Second example is their second category is closed. And the third category is isolated. Now, don't worry about the fact that this says isolated. That's wrong. The book is wrong about this. But just listen to what I'm saying. Here's the difference. An open thermodynamic system is a system that can exchange both energy and materials with the surroundings. A closed thermodynamic system is one that can exchange energy but not materials with the surroundings. And an isolated thermodynamic system can't exchange energy or materials with the surroundings. Now, that third one, isolated, is really just a concept, just for the purpose of thinking about all of this stuff. There really is no such thing as a truly isolated thermodynamic system. But for instance, if you think about a well-insulated container, like a thermos or a Dewar flask, that's trying to be isolated, really. It's just impossible to be truly isolated. It's closed because the lid keeps exchange of material from happening. And it's trying to keep energy from being transferred, which is why it keeps things hot for so long or cold for so long compared to the surroundings. But it can't be perfect. And you wait long enough, a hot thing in a thermos is going to be hot the next day or the next week. Right? There is some leakage. So there's really no real isolated system. And that's why this book got it wrong here. This one on top is really a closed thermodynamic system. And it's specifically a hydroelectric system because it's using the flow of water to create electricity. This is how dams work, right? But you can see just by the figure that this isn't isolated because there's a light. The light lighting up is a transfer of energy. If there were no transfer of energy, we wouldn't see it. But anyway, it's truly closed, but there is no exchange of materials. Water, the only water that's in there is what's in there originally. And at first, there is a gradient, right? There's a gravitational gradient because the water in one tank is higher than the level in the other tank. Therefore, water wants to fall downhill. And since it can through this tunnel, it will. And when that happens, it will turn the turbine. That creates electricity and lights the light. But since it's a closed system, eventually it will attain equilibrium gravitationally, and the levels in the two tanks will be the same. There is then no tendency for water to go from one tank to the other. So it stops turning the turbine and therefore no electricity. Well, this does not represent a living organism very well. No organism that is alive can ever be a closed system thermodynamically. And I told you this for different reason a while ago. before we even talked about thermodynamics, I said to remain alive, we talked about this when we were talking about surface area to volume ratio. To remain alive, a cell, and therefore an organism, has to continuously exchange both energy and materials with the surroundings. That, by definition, makes every organism an open thermodynamic system. All right. So we are more like B. This one's open because there's a continuous influx of water and an efflux of water out the other end. By continually adding water and draining it at the other end, you can maintain the gradient. And therefore, water will continue to spin the turbine, and therefore it'll continue to make electricity. So that kind of represents an organism. We can remain alive, which is kind of what the light bulb represents, by this exchange of energy and materials. But we're better represented by the multi-step system, which is also an open system, but it's multi-step. So instead of using this entire gradient in one shot, which is the gradient is like the difference in the water levels. Instead, this is the same gradient from beginning to the very end of the multi-step, but instead of using it in one step, a little bit is released at a time. This is how we do things. We don't release all of the energy from our fuel molecules that came from food just immediately. That would be an explosion. That would kill us. And even if it didn't kill us, we wouldn't be able to capture a lot of that useful energy. It would simply make us very hot. And that's why it would probably kill us. Instead, we release the energy a little bit at a time so that it can be released in manageable amounts with the intent of storing some of that energy to be used for useful purposes known as cellular work. Okay, so we're like the third one most of all. We're definitely not like the first one, the closed system. All right, so that brings us to 7. You should already know what this molecule is, even though it's not labeled. What are we looking at here? Well, if you don't know the specific name of this chemical, you should know what it's an example of. Yeah, it's not RNA, because RNA is a polymer. But RNA is made out of monomers like this one. This can be a monomer of RNA. Nucleic acids are polymers, right? What are the monomers that make them up called? So think about your three polymers. You have proteins or polypeptides made out of monomers called amino acids. You have polysaccharides made out of monomers called monosaccharides. And you have nucleic acids made out of monomers called what? Nucleotides, which is why another name for a nucleic acid is a polynucleotide. This is ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which has an important role, not related to this chapter, as a monomer for building RNA. Remember, there's 4 different kinds of nucleotides that RNA is made out of? Well, this is one of them. Now, think back to when we talked about nucleotides. We saw it was DNA at the time, but just one of the nucleotides was then shown in the middle of the slide in detail. And I said, even though it is a subunit, you can break it down into 3 pieces, right? A nucleotide features 3 components for it to be a nucleotide. One of which is a pentose sugar. In this case, it's ribose, not deoxyribose, which is why if this is used to build a nucleic acid, it's going to be RNA, not DNA. But to be a nucleotide, you have to have a pentose sugar and then 2 things attached at different places to that sugar. One of which is some sort of nitrogenous base, which in this particular case is adenine. And then also hooked to that sugar, but at the other end, is a phosphate, at least 1 phosphate. If you have all three of those requirements met, then you are a nucleotide. But I don't remember whether when I introduced this word or not, you can think about everything except the phosphate. In other words, just the nitrogenous base and the sugar. Still connected, but that's all there is. What is that called? Just those two components, did I say? The sugar and the nitrogenous base by themselves are called a nucleoside, with an S instead of a T. Okay? So, yes, you can call ATP a nucleotide, but it's more descriptive to call it a nucleoside triphosphate. Because just saying that it's a nucleotide doesn't tell you how many phosphates there are. It has to be at least one to be a nucleotide, but it can be more. Okay, so it's a nucleoside triphosphate. And that's valuable as a monomer of RNA, but that's a totally different use of this same molecule. What we care about in this unit is ATP's equally important job of serving as a energy-carrying molecule. An energetic middleman, in a sense, that has very short-term storage of energy, by which I mean, effectively, as soon as you build this thing to store some energy, you're going to reverse the process and break it back down to release the energy to do something for you. So we don't keep these as ATP very long. But the reason that it is an energy-carrying molecule is because there's a lot of energy tied up in the chemical bonds between the phosphate groups. So, to use this ATP, which we've already been talking about, right? We, for instance, using it to power a pump, sodium-potassium exchange pump, for instance. Whatever you're using it for, when you use an ATP, what you're doing is breaking one of these phosphate-phosphate bonds. If you break this terminal bond, you now turn that ATP, adenosine triphosphate, into adenosine diphosphate and have an extra phosphate on its own. Think about that in terms of metabolism. You're breaking a bigger, more complex thing into smaller, less complex things, right? That's catabolic, which should correspond to exergonic. It's going to release energy. Some of that energy is going to be wasted as heat because of the second law, and there's nothing you can do about that. But the rest of the energy can be put to use doing something valuable for you in the cell, which is what I mean by cellular work. Okay, so we see this happening in slide 8. Starting here with adenosine triphosphate, which is a nucleoside triphosphate. Adenosine, by the way, is the specific nucleoside. It is adenine and ribose together. That's called adenosine. And then three phosphates. Notice, though, that we're cleaving off this terminal phosphate, and that's why it's now inorganic phosphate, which is what the I stands for, remember. It's just a phosphorus and four oxygens. It's not connected to any carbon skeleton, so it's inorganic. It's on its own. The other two are still connected to the adenosine, so it's an adenosine diphosphate now, an ADP molecule. And that's an exergonic reaction, breaking a big complex thing into smaller, less complex things, which is why you have energy coming out of the situation. Some of that energy, as I said, is wasted as heat, but that energy that's released used to be the energy that you had to put into building this ATP molecule originally. And where does that energy come from? The food, originally, the food that you eat, provides the fuel. Once you digest that food into individual molecules that are small enough to serve as fuels inside cells, then you break apart those fuel molecules, which is what this upcoming chapter will be all about, glycolysis and cellular respiration. That's going to release energy because you're breaking fuels into smaller and less complex things. That's catabolism. Okay? The energy that's released from the fuel that isn't wasted as heat can be captured by building an ATP, by reversing this process, by taking an ADP and hooking another phosphate onto it to make it ATP. Now the ATP molecule has energy that used to be in the food. But now you can then reverse the process and break it back into ADP and inorganic phosphate to release the energy to do something valuable for you. Now, this is why ATP is like an energetic middleman. Because there's all kinds of endergonic processes that have to happen in the cell. By definition, those require energy, right? They're not going to happen otherwise, but they have to happen to keep you alive. So you have to supply energy. But we don't use the energy that's released from our fuel molecules that came from food directly to power those endergonic processes. Instead, we use an energetic middleman, ATP. The energy that comes from the fuel is used to build ATP, which then is used by dismantling it to release energy to power the endergonic processes. This is why a lot of books will describe ATP as the energy currency of the cell, by analogy with money, which is currency. It's actually not so much like cash as it is a debit card. Because any given amount of cash has a constant value. It doesn't change, right? But a debit card can have a high balance or a low balance. And when you make a deposit into the debit card account, you're investing it with money. That's analogous to building an ATP. You make a deposit of energy that came from your food to hook another phosphate on to make this molecule store more energy than it was. It has a higher balance. Now think about what your job is. Nowadays, effectively, no one works directly for the things that person needs. You don't work for food. You don't work for clothing or anything else. Instead, you work for money, right? The money represents your effort. But the reason you work for money is because money is so versatile. You can use it for all kinds of different things, not just for food or not just for clothing. And similarly, the energy that comes from our food is not used directly to do the things that require energy that we need to do, those endergonic processes. Instead, we use it, the food molecules, directly to build ATP to store that energy, which we then spend, because it's so versatile a molecule, in a variety of ways to power all these kinds of different kinds of endergonic processes. This is, if you follow the direction of the arrow in this case, because this is a reversible, of course. You can go up in the slide or downward. Going downward, as it's shown, what kind of reaction is this? Notice that water is required here. Well, yes, it's exergonic in terms of energy flow. But what other word could you describe this that it has to do with the fact that it requires water? It's a hydrolysis reaction. Remember that water gets split so that H can be hooked onto something, OH can be hooked onto something else. Well, you're splitting a big thing into chunks. That's hydrolysis. But that, you're right, that's also exergonic. That's when you use ATP, when you spend it. But the next moment, which can be just a tiny fraction of a second later, energy that came from food originally, but by burning fuel in the process of glycolysis and cellular respiration that we're about to get to in the next chapter, will be used to build this thing back up again by hooking a phosphate, not necessarily the same phosphate, but a phosphate that's in the pool of phosphates in your cells, onto the ADP to turn it back into ATP. That's like making another deposit in the account, right? and then you can spend it again. So you have a pool of not just ATP and ADP, but also AMP, adenosine monophosphate, which is also a nucleotide, right? But it's a nucleoside monophosphate, only one phosphate left. So AD, this is why I like to use debit card as an example rather than cash, because ADP is not as high a balance as ATP, but that doesn't mean you can't buy something still. So you can use the energy, some of the energy in ADP as well by doing the same thing. If you hook off, if you detach this phosphate, that turns it into AMP, which is a lower balance still. Okay? So you have all three forms in your cells, AMP, ADP, and ATP. Most of it is ADP and ATP, going back and forth between those forms. And that's because if AMP starts to build up, that's a really strong signal to the cell saying, you need to make a deposit. Getting low in your energy storing molecules. That's an emergency situation. So that will cause the body to burn more fuel to release more energy to hook on a bunch more phosphates to turn the AMP into ADP and ATP. Okay, we can see this ATP use specifically using a specific example in slide 9. And the specific example doesn't really matter, but we'll just follow it as an example. Glutamic acid is an amino acid, and it's going to be combined with ammonia to form glutamine. Now, it doesn't matter what glutamine is or why the cell needs it. The point is, the cell needs glutamine at the moment. But notice that that's a positive delta G reaction to build that molecule, as you would expect, right? You're building a more complex thing out of less complex things. It's energetically uphill. Cell requires it, though, so it has to happen. But it's never going to happen on its own because of the delta, positive delta G. It's non-spontaneous. Therefore, the cell has to force it to happen. Well, if you look at the coupling of this endergonic reaction with the exergonic hydrolysis of ATP, which we just looked at in the previous slide, then you have a system that can cause this to happen. Notice in the two numbered reactions, in the first one, number one, you have glutamic acid and ATP being transformed into a phosphorylated glutamic acid. So one of the three phosphates from ATP gets hooked onto glutamic acid. That, in effect, energizes the glutamic acid. And that, of course, leaves ADP, a spent ATP, right? So you've spent some energy, but you've energized a reactant. Now this phosphorylated and energized glutamic acid can react with ammonia to form glutamine, and the phosphate gets popped off. So what's happening here is that in order to force an endergonic reaction to occur, the cell is coupling it to an exergonic reaction, forming a new system, a new thermodynamic system that is the combination of the two systems. And therefore, the overall delta G, which is the sum of the two individual delta Gs, is negative. Okay, the hydrolysis of ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate, it has a negative delta G. That's an exothermic spontaneous reaction. Negative 7.3 kilocalories per mole. The thing you're trying to drive has a positive delta G. But by coupling them, as what we described in the middle, you have this new system, which is the sum of the two, and that adds up to a negative 3.9 kilocalories per mole. Okay, so you're coupling an exergonic reaction with an endergonic reaction in order to force it to happen. Now, what if the hydrolysis of ATP had a negative delta G a delta G of exactly negative 3.4, which is exactly what's required for the other reaction, the endergonic reaction? Would that happen?
no change would occur.
Well, it doesn't necessarily say that. It would mean that the delta G overall would be zero, but the reason it wouldn't happen is because if the delta G of the ATP hydrolysis is exactly negative 3.4, that's not enough to provide 3.4 for this one because of the second law of thermodynamics. Some of that energy is always going to be wasted as heat. You can't. Another way of saying that is there's no such thing as a 100% efficient thermodynamic process. So you're going to lose some of the energy. Well, you have more than enough energy here, though. So even with wasting some as heat, you still have enough left over to drive this endergonic reaction. The overall is negative. Okay, I've used the phrase cellular work a couple times earlier today, and slide 10 shows you two major categories of cellular work that ATP can be used to power. First, you have transport work, which refers specifically to transmembrane transport, as I've described it earlier in different chapters, meaning moving things either into or out of the cell. Well, you don't need ATP to do that if things are moving into or out of the cell down their gradient, right? The gradient itself powers that. That's known as diffusion. That's passive. What we're talking about here is active transport. Moving things against their gradient, which you have to force them to do, that requires some sort of energy, which is typically ATP. But the other major category here is mechanical work, which is also involves movement, but this is referring to moving things around, like the motor proteins walking on the microtubules of the cytoskeleton, as we've talked about. Every individual step of the motor protein requires a fresh ATP, which will get turned into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And then you can recharge that back into ATP by using energy that came from your fuel of your foods. 11 puts it still another way. This really is a good figure to show the middleman aspect, but I've already said this in words. We use the energy released from exergonic reactions, which are catabolic, because we catabolize our fuels, break them down to release the energy. We use that energy, though, directly to build ATP out of ADP and inorganic phosphate. That stores the energy that used to be in the food. And then we use the ATP's energy directly to power the various endergonic reactions that the cell requires. That's why it's an energetic middleman. But it's a cycle here because every time you use ATP, it's going to go back into ADP and inorganic phosphate. Every time you create an ATP, you use those two things to stick together to make the ATP, investing it with energy. 12. Well, this should be familiar what you're looking at here. What kind of molecule is this at the top? Did I say this should be familiar to you? What is sucrose? It is a sugar. What kind of sugar? No. No. No, it's a disaccharide. It's made out of two monosaccharides, right? So it's disaccharide. And what is the bond holding them together? Holding the two constituent monosaccharides together in sucrose? That's not a bond, that's an atom. What is the name of the bond that holds two monosaccharides together? No? Those are functional groups, not bonds.
Covalent?
Yes, it is covalent, but specifically what kind of covalent bond is it? After the test, you're not allowed to forget this stuff. The idea is to remember it for all your other biology courses that you'll take. It's a glycosidic linkage. right? That's what makes a disaccharide stick together as two monosaccharides stick together as a disaccharide. Well, that's being broken here, which is why you're liberating the two constituent monosaccharides, glucose and fructose. That's the product here. Just in terms of the word, the pairs of antonyms that we talked about, how would you describe this process in terms of metabolism? In terms of catabolism, and it's not dehydration, by the way, but that's another thing. It's not anabolic. It's catabolic. You're breaking a bigger, more complex thing into smaller, less complex things. That's catabolism. How would you describe it on energetic grounds? It is exergonic, exactly. When you break a complex thing into smaller chunks, you're releasing energy. So yes, it's exergonic. And what about in terms of whether or not it's going to happen on its own?
Spontaneous.
Now, spontaneous means that it can happen on its own. It doesn't at all necessarily mean that it will happen anytime soon. So there's plenty of spontaneous reactions as part of your metabolism that would take lifetimes before they happened. Obviously, that's too long to remain alive, right? This is why you need the help of enzymes to speed up even spontaneous reactions, to cause them to happen soon enough for you to remain alive. And that's exactly the job of this thing in lavender. Sucrase. What kind of thing is sucrase? The ASE ending should tell you what this thing is. It is an enzyme. That's in general the job of an enzyme, to speed up a reaction without being an actual reactant in that reaction. Right? The reactant is sucrose. The products are glucose and fructose. The enzyme is neither of those. That's why you don't write it before the arrow or after the arrow. You write it beside or above the arrow on a horizontally written one. So it's not a bystander. It plays a role. It interacts with the reactant, which is called the substrate. The substrate is simply the reactant in a catalyzed reaction. It's the thing that binds to the enzyme. And by so doing, the enzyme drastically speeds up the transformation of reactant into product. But that can happen on its own without the enzyme's help at all. The enzyme's not required. It just might not happen in time for you to remain alive. So typically an enzyme speeds up a reaction at least a million times, typically multiple millions of times faster with an enzyme. Enzymes, by the way, their names don't always end in ASE, but they often do. That's a good indicator that you're looking at the name of an enzyme. And also, aside from the ASE ending, they are typically named either for what they do or for what their substrate is that they bind to. In this case, it's named after the substrate. The substrate is sucrose, the sugar. The enzyme is sucrase. Now, what you were saying about dehydration was just the opposite. It was wrong. This is a hydrolysis reaction, not a dehydration. If you were to run it backwards and build sucrose out of glucose and fructose, water would be removed, right? That's why that's called dehydration, to form the more complex one. This is doing the opposite. It's splitting the bigger into smaller. That requires water, which splits it, hydrolysis. Okay, let's look at another graph in slide 13. And this is a generalized graph, so it's not actually any specific reaction, but it's a reaction with two reactants, something made out of A and B atoms, and something made out of C and D atoms, that when they react, form an AC thing and a BD thing, product. The point here is that any reaction is going to involve the breaking of some bonds and the formation of some bonds in order to transform whatever the reactant is to whatever the product is. Right? There's no addition or subtraction of material. It's the same atoms. They're just rearranged. So you have to break some bonds and you have to form some bonds. And that doesn't happen just instantaneously. Just like getting from point A to point B, unless you can teleport, is not instantaneous, right? You have to temporarily be somewhere that's not A or B. Similarly, in any given chemical reaction, the reactants need to go through a transition state, which is neither reactant nor product, but somewhere in between. The squiggled lines here represent bonds that are not, that they're in the process of being broken, and new ones are in the process of being formed. And unless you go through that transition state, you can't get to the products. But notice what's being plotted here on the vertical axis. Free energy, G. Now, this particular example, how would you describe this chemical reaction energetically based on free energy? It is exergonic, because you end up with lower G than you started with, right? G final minus G initial is going to be a negative number. Exergonic corresponds to spontaneous, right? So you'd expect this thing to happen on its own. But like I said, it doesn't mean it's going to happen anytime soon. Because notice that the highest value of G here, this transition state, is higher than the reactant value and the product value. The additional energy here, represented by the length of this arrow, is called the energy of activation, or E sub A. Activation energy is another phrase for it. And so it's like a hill that you have to climb to get over in order to then roll down the other side of the hill to get to the products. So even though, yes, it is true that this is exergonic, because products G is lower than reactants G, you still have to get over this hill. You have to have enough energy to get to the transition state. And depending on how high this hill is, that might be difficult or easy. Importantly, though, the activation energy, notice, has nothing to do with delta G. Delta G is based only on the final G and the initial G, not anything that happens in between. Okay, you see how those are totally separate measurements? Okay, well, if we look at the next slide, which is exactly the same graph for the black trace, slide 14, but the red trace is the same exact reaction with a lower activation energy. Notice the delta G is exactly the same thing. It's not changed, but the activation energy is reduced. The hill is smaller to get over, and therefore it makes it more likely that it's going to happen. This is exactly what enzymes in general do. They operate specifically in different ways depending on the enzyme, but all enzymes operate by changing and reducing the value of activation energy. Okay, they make this hill smaller. Just as importantly, no enzyme ever changes the value of delta G. Messing with this hill does not at all affect the difference between product and reactant G. All right, so it says its delta G is unaffected by the enzyme. But if the enzyme is able to make this hill small enough, then it will be just the thermal energy in the system will be enough to get it over that. And that will make it happen a hell of a lot quicker than without the help of the enzyme. That's what I meant when I said millions of times faster with the help of an enzyme. So remind me that I'm on slide 15 when we resume.